Thanks so much again. I'll be back next week, Tuesday, 6 to 7 p.m. And take care, mask up, and love up on the ones you love. Up next is Right on Radio.
Fresh Air Community Radio is KFAI FM, Minneapolis, St. Paul. Online and archived at kfai.org. It's where community grows.
The viewpoints expressed in this program are the opinions of the people expressing them and are not necessarily those of Fresh Air Incorporated, its staff, or its board of directors.
You're listening to KFAI on 90.3 FM in Minneapolis and streaming on the web at kfai.org.
Hi, welcome to Right on Radio. My name is Emma, and today our guest is Debbie Russell. She is here to talk about her book, Crossing 51, Not Quite a Memoir, a book that highlights the struggles of addiction and dysfunctional family dynamics. Hi, Debbie. Thank you so much for coming in.
Hi, Emma, and thanks so much for having me. I'm thrilled to be here.
All right. Just a quick, I noticed on your blurb and your email signatures, you are a self-described lawyer turned writer. Can you describe that kind of career path a little bit and just a brief introduction about you?
Sure. Well, for almost 30 years, I was an assistant Hennepin County attorney, and I spent most of my career as a criminal prosecutor. So I prosecuted a whole lot of violent and terrible crimes, and I had always planned to take retirement at 55, which is when I first was eligible for a very small pension, and that happened in 2020. And I always knew I had at least one book to write, and so that's what I have been doing. I started this book, it was Thanksgiving week of 2020, and it was published in 2023. So I've been on the book adventure ever since.
So just extrapolate a little bit more about writing a book. Was there the idea of there's always authors of I just want to write a book for the sake of writing a book. Was there something specific that you're I want to focus on this specific theme, or a memoir, or was it just a big idea and then something just kind of sparked?
Well, as you know, Emma, the book is partially my grandfather's story, mm-hmm. which is told through letters. And I originally found this file folder of letters in 2005. And I was 40 years old, still quite in the throes of my primary career. But I read through the letters and they really resonated with me on an emotional level. And I never knew my grandfather. And my grandmother died, I think, when I was close to 30. But I remember thinking that the story, the narrative arc of these letters, of my grandfather's four-month stay in a voluntary locked rehab program, was just a phenomenal story in and of itself. So originally, that's what the book was going to be about, mm-hmm. was just my grandfather's experience going through drug rehabilitation. But then fast forward, and I'm living my own life, and my dad goes into hospice, and there's a whole lot of family dynamics going on. We'll just use that word for now. And what I realized at the time I started to sit down and figure out what did I want this book to be about, I felt like there was part of my story that I could weave in to my grandfather's story. I mean, he was 51 when he went into the rehab program. I was 51 when my dad went into hospice. And so all of a sudden, I'm looking at kind of some of the commonalities that we have as we go through midlife that you might have to look forward to down the road.
Like the other questions that I have is like some of the letters, like when I go back and look at my great grandmother's handwriting, things like that, I actually really struggle quite a bit with the cursive. Was it pretty difficult to decipher some of the handwriting, or was it pretty straightforward?
So initially when my grandfather was at the facility, he was handwriting his letters, and they were a tough read. To decipher some of the words. As he went through the program, he started to get more privileges. And so I'd say maybe a month in, 6 weeks in, he got access to a typewriter. And so that was fabulous. Now, my grandmother, hers was always the cursive writing. But I was lucky with them. They were decent cursive writers. I do think, you know, back in the day, cursive writing was taught, you know, very thoroughly. And so people came out of those eras, those generations, with really decent handwriting.
My great-grandmother's handwriting and my grandmother's handwriting, it's like, it's just beautiful, right, cursive. But sometimes I'm like, I have to sit with like magnifying glass. And I'm like, what did you write here? It's incredible. Right. One of the things that really struck about this book was like how you can also like look at like a grandparent's or a great grandparent's like history through letters, which I think we kind of lose a little bit now in the digital age with like emails. Like sometimes those are archived, but you don't really have a physical copy of an email unless you print it out. So what was it like emotionally discovering a different aspect of your grandpa while going through these letters?
Such a great question. And again, to have this file folder, it's hard to describe, but it was just kind of a nondescript file folder, but it had a rubber band around it. And I just thought, well, what is this? It was in a box of all these other things that had been kind of my dad's memorabilia. And I opened it up, and right on the very top was this envelope that had my grandfather's ID card that he had been issued when he went into this facility, because it was correctional based and it was locked, even though the inside was meant to feel more homey and less of a prison type setting. But then each letter was just in really pristine condition and in order, chronological order. So the first, you know, couple letters where he is writing to the director of the United States Public Health agency asking whether they thought he might be appropriate for inpatient treatment, and really being very candid about how much he was using. And then the correspondence back from the agency, and then his first letter to my grandmother. It was just astonishing to feel like, it's like, I think when you open up a time capsule.
Exactly. Yeah, that's the first. It's like a time. It is a time capsule. It's a familial time capsule. I don't know. Did you expect like your grandpa to like have those letters reread in the future? Did you ever think of that?
Well, he did note in several of his letters, he would put at the bottom, save my letters. Save my letters. I want to have a record of this. But in talking to my aunt, who is the youngest of the children, I say children, she was 14 when he went into the facility. She really didn't know much about what had happened. And I believe it was my grandmother who did take my grandfather's wishes seriously and just organize them. But I think once he came home and once that was behind them, I think the file folder just got put away into a box, because when I pulled them out, it was with, at least with my dad and my aunt, it was sort of like, oh, it was like they were reminded of this.
Oh, interesting.
Episode.
Yeah.
Yes, because by the time I brought them out again, I would say 60 years had gone by.
Yeah.
And it is funny how, you know, as we age, things that we might have held close as secrets can all of a sudden actually disappear. If you never speak to anyone about a secret, all of a sudden it's like it doesn't exist. So here I am, and I pull out this, like, what's this?
Was it difficult to like write the memoir? Like when you were talking to your family and relatives about writing this book, were they like, what were some of the reactions that you got about the memoir, where like some people are like, families were like, no, don't mention my name, or like things like that.
Well, I tried to be careful about that in terms of, I offered for names to be changed. Certainly with friends and other professionals that I dealt with, I did change their names. What was interesting is I think there was just a bit of skepticism that I would actually do this. So I was, you know, I said, this is what I'm doing. And as part of getting the book all sort of pulled together, I interviewed my aunt for many hours. She's in San Diego. And so we would have these very long phone calls. And I had a list of questions because there were things I just needed to try to understand from her memory of that time. And again, she was 14 years old, and she was in her early 80s when I interviewed her about all of this. So it was tricky. And then I think for her, she did go through this, like, is this really gonna be a book? And then when I signed the contract with my publisher, I said, would you like to see the manuscript? And her first response was, will I be embarrassed?
Oh,
I know. And I said, well, I sure hope not, because that was never my intent. And she read it all in, and this was just the manuscript, read it all in just a few days and just loved it. With my mother and my brother, it's a whole different story. And I am estranged from both of them. And it's unfortunate because I don't view the book as being about them. They are characters in the book for sure. But my book is an homage to my dad and to my grandfather and how they inspired me to kind of pull myself out of my own midlife crisis. So it's been kind of across the board.
Yeah. Oh, that's so fascinating. Because like I know of like family estrangement and everything else. Like I do have my own familial issues as well, estrangement. So that's like kind of clinged onto that. And what I like about this book specifically is it's like, oh, what am I going to look forward to in like 20, 30 years? And then look back on like my grandparents, my great grandparents, because like right now I have like a very youthy angst about everything. So hopefully that'll mellow out. I have a kind of fun logistics question. It's in the book, you do have like the physical like pictures of the letters themselves. Were there ones that are like, this is what I want in here, what I don't want in here? How did you go through that kind of artistic process of like which letters to include and which ones not to include?
That is a great question. And I do have to give a shout out to the designer with my publisher, because they were really so open to my ideas about things. And I think they said I could have up to 30 photos that could be included. And so, but what was so amazing is I got to sort of look at the interior of the book and say, this is, in at least in the text, this is where I would like this photo to go, or this is where I would like this letter to go. And oh my gosh, my designer was just a wizard as far as how she put them in their little spaces. And I'm so delighted as to the whole, how the book came out, because the product to me is just, it's just beautiful. And I remember when I first got, I think it was the PDF version, and I opened it up and I just started, I mean, the tears just started. I was so overwhelmed emotionally with how this had come out of my brain and was now out into the world.
Perfect. The next follow-up question I have for that is, was it therapeutic to like kind of write this book and just kind of jot everything down? Like, was it like a form of like therapy to you, at least? Would you describe it like that?
So they have a rule for memoir that you're supposed to wait 5 years from whatever it is you're writing about. And of course, they always say memoir should not be an autobiography, right? So when I was trying to figure out just how much of my own life I wanted to put in, it certainly centered around the period of time that I realized I was operating with a very limited amount of time with my dad, who I adored more than anyone in the entire world. And so I will say that reliving that time frame, that was, I hope, the hardest, work that I will ever write in my life. I was reliving a lot of grief all over again, and also a lot of the kind of the family, I don't want to say trauma, but just the chaos that was sort of going with my family at that time. And I think a lot of us midlifers who have older parents that were trying to navigate that chapter of their lives. And then I didn't have children of my own, but I know friends of mine that do. They have their own children that they're trying to navigate their lives. And so there's all of this going on, and nobody seems to be on the same page. And for me, it became kind of this comparison of how it appeared as though when my grandfather just sort of went up and left the family to go do this rehab program, that my grandmother just said, well, here's what we need to do. And everybody seemed to be quite supportive of all of it. Whereas when my dad was starting to fail and we were having all these things, it just felt like my family unit just couldn't. It was a big struggle, and everybody was kind of almost attacking each other as opposed to like, we need to all be on the same page. And it's just, it's different.
Family dynamic, especially in like individualistic society, especially like Western culture, where it is like you are or your own family unit and everything else versus like something that's like more collective, and just causes a lot of friction, especially for like career professionals. If you move cross state lines, like I have to think of taking care of my family back out on the East Coast and all that family dynamics, and like my sibling as well, like how involved are they gonna be when like they come sick, is like always, it's in the back of my mind. It's always like something that's like, oh, as I'm getting older, that's gonna be something that's very anxiety inducing. The follow-up question I have is like mostly working with the therapists in the book, and like your relationship with the therapist as a whole, like, can you describe how it was writing that and like kind of going back through that experience?
I can, because it was not great.
Yeah.
And, it was interesting. And I, as I write in the book, I started therapy, I think it was the end of 2016. And I really believe that COVID sort of brought mental health much more to the forefront. I think people are much more fluent in therapy, much more knowledgeable about therapy. I didn't know what I was getting myself into. And based on that, I just ended up with somebody, and I stayed with my first therapist for, I think, far longer than I should have, except for the fact that I didn't know any better. Like, I just didn't have any, I'm a lawyer, I'm very good at what I was doing in my job, and I just always have assumed that people in other professions are also very good at their job. And at least with my first therapist, it was like, I'm not getting anything out of this. I'm just going to stop going. And then I stopped going. And then I had some physical issues that brought me back in. And then I don't want to give away yeah. some of the good yeah. parts of the book, because here's the thing, I've come to realize, well, if I had had a good therapist, I might not have had a good book.
Yeah.
So we'll leave that aside yeah. for a second. But my second therapist, who I at least got on with quite a bit better, and I ended up interviewing her for the book as well, because I said, what is your knowledge of dysfunctional family systems? And she didn't really have any. There were a couple things that I asked her about. And basically I said, well, what is your therapeutic process or protocol? And she says, well, I just create a safe space for people to talk. And I was like, oh gosh, I don't need that.
Yeah.
Like, I can talk yeah. to anybody about anything. I mean, I really needed somebody to give me tools. I've come to learn about cognitive behavioral therapy. I think that's something I could have benefited from. And it's something I've tried to sort of do my own self-study, because it's just basically training yourself how to think differently about whatever it is that's coming at you. So,
but like a really good comment that you made about 2020, and especially COVID being like the hypersensitive of like mental health, and it always seems like anything dealing with like dysfunctional families, or like, we don't have to say trauma, but it's like sometimes it's just like, okay, slap a therapist onto that, and then we're just going to move on. And as somebody who's been in regular therapy, it took me 3 or 4 therapists multiple times just to find somebody that I'm comfortable with. And I feel like I got like a BA in psychology just going through like the entire Googling.
Good for
it's
you.
Just like, but it felt like it sometimes when it comes to like dysfunctional family units, it's like how do you cope with that? I think was the big thing from like me and my therapist. Like, how do you cope with the structure? Because I can't change any of my family members' behavior. But hopefully I could try to change my own.
Right.
Was something that I've always gotten through.
Exactly.
The other question that I have is, what advice would you get for like a writer like trying to do something like this to like any of our audience members that are like, ooh, maybe I want to write like a little pseudo memoir about like my family dysfunction? You have any advice?
Well, I like to just say just write, because I know people get hung up on, I'm not a good writer. Well, get the stuff out mm-hmm. first, and then figure out what you want to do with it second. And I had a brilliant editor, because especially when we're writing our own story or a story that is so close to us, this could have just been for me, but I felt like it had more wide-ranging themes that could appeal to a wider audience. And so I did hire a professional editor, and what was fascinating is she could tell when I was just skimming the surface of things. And she said, I think there's way more here than you are describing. Mm-hmm. And, you know, she probably acted as a third therapist for me in terms of some of the things that I was writing where I was describing my own emotions or reactions to things, and there I'd get a little note in the margin, I'm not sure I understand what you're trying to say here. And so I don't know, I think a lot of people say, you know, I don't have a story, or my story isn't important. And what I have come to find, especially through this book and events that I do and book clubs that I meet with, everybody has a story. And I think we tend to just make ourselves seem less important, but everybody's story is important. And family is such a tough, challenging world to live in, because there are all these cultural expectations on how we should be interacting with family just because they are family. And not everybody can get what they need from their family. And so I don't know. I just think that if you've got a story in you, just write it down. And then if you want to share it, you know, share it with a friend. You know, there are so many writing groups, reader groups out there. I mean, but writing also can be really very therapeutic. And they always say, I think most therapists will say, journal because then it's out of your head,
yeah,
and it's somewhere else. And that can be really very, very beneficial.
All right. Thank you so much. My last question before you read a little excerpt from your book is, what do you want audience members, listeners to take away from your book? What is like the big like relatability factor, do you think, to like a general KFAI listener audience?
Well, as I said, yeah, you know, we all have a family,
yeah,
right? And they're all different. And one of the things that really has struck me over the several years that this book has been out is to hear from people about my book, because I thought, oh, I'm writing about my life and my grandfather's life. But people say, it's like you were writing about my life. And I think, boy, you know, so I guess what I would say is we have more in common than we don't. I think it's Maya Angelou that says we are more alike, my friend, than we are unalike.
Yep.
And I do think it's, you know, this may be my story of a set time in my life and then my grandfather's life. But I think there is something that people who like genealogy, family history, the study of addiction and how we treat addiction and all of those other things, I think they can find something worthwhile in the book.
Perfect. That is an excellent note to end on, Debbie. And thank you so much. Debbie will now read a little excerpt from her book, starting on chapter 5, I believe.
Yes.
All right.
Yes. So this is just a little bit of a setup. So I go back and forth in time between 1951 and 2015, 16, 17. So this is Christmas of 2016. I'm going to be late. Of course I am. Even though I put the clinic's address into my phone's GPS, I managed to take the wrong exit and set myself up to arrive late for my first therapy appointment. Let the self-loathing commence. I am not the type who arrives late or gets lost, or at least I didn't used to be. The irony is not lost on me that today I am the very stereotype of the tardy, unglued person who needs therapy. I turned 51 a couple of months ago, the exact same age as Papa when he walked away from his medical practice and requested admission into a locked federal facility seeking treatment for a Demerol addiction. This must be what a midlife crisis looks like in my family. What is it with us type A overachievers? Rather than dabble in drugs or take up more drinking, I decide to give therapy a try. Except that finding a therapist is a bit more complicated than picking out a nice bottle of Chardonnay or deciding which Netflix series to binge. It's not like I can just ask someone for a recommendation, like I would for a landscaper or car mechanic. Besides, nobody I know is in therapy. Everyone seems to have their lives well in order with lots of Facebook posts to prove it. To be fair, I post my share of happy events or thoughts of gratitude or whatever I think might generate enough likes to make me feel better about myself. I also had myself convinced that I could land the plane for Dad in a way that would be supportive and helpful. Until the day when, much like Humpty Dumpty, I fell off the wall and couldn't seem to put myself back together again or find my way to a therapy appointment.
All right. Thank you so much. This was Debbie Russell on Ride On Radio today to talk about her book, Crossing 51, Not Quite a Memoir. Thank you so much for being on with us tonight, Debbie.
Thanks so much. It was such a pleasure.
Support for KFAI comes from First Avenue, presenting Bathtub Sig at the 7th Street Entry, Saturday, January 3rd. Bathtub Sig is the bedroom pop project of Hillary James. Since 2017, Bathtub Sig has released singles, EPs, and a full album. Their music looks to evoke private moments of contemplation and small comforts as we move through our modern world. Opening the show is Kiernan and Nona Envy. More information about Bathtub Sig at the 7th Street Entry is available at first-avenue.com.
Support for KFAI comes from The Dakota, presenting Carl Denson's Tiny Universe, Friday, January 2nd. Saxophonist, flutist, and vocalist Carl Denson brings his Tiny Universe ensemble to The Dakota. For almost 30 years, they've brought their brand of soul, funk, and R&B fusion around the world again and again. They're touring with their latest release, Gnomes and Badgers. More information about Carl Denson's Tiny Universe at The Dakota is available at dakotacooks.com.
You're listening to KFAI on 90.3 FM in Minneapolis and streaming on the web at kfai.org. Welcome to Right On Radio.
Today I have Paul Cruz and Shelby Richardson, the playwright and director, respectively, of Hot Dish here at KFAI's Right On Radio. Thank you so much for being here, you two.
Thanks for having us, Emma.
Yeah, thank you, Emma. Thanks for having us here.
So this is going to be really, really fun. Can both of you describe, or Paul, can you describe the concept of Hot Dish?
Yeah, absolutely. So Hot Dish is a surreal farce, is what we're calling it, about and for the women who raised me and who made me, who I grew up with. And so it follows a group of Midwestern women who we meet at a potluck. And one of them has recently died, but showed up anyway. And then the Virgin Mary comes out of a refrigerator, and we learn pretty quickly is running a multi-level marketing scheme. And the play just gets a little stranger from there. And I could say the play, I grew up in La Crosse, Wisconsin. I'm from the upper Midwest. And I've been lucky to move back to live in Minneapolis to be near family again. And so my downstairs neighbors are actually one of my brothers and his family. And all of my, I've two other brothers who live in the area, and my parents are close by, and my extended family is all here. And so I've, in the last 5 years, just been immersed in family. And so I've been thinking a lot about kind of what the culture of this place is and been writing about it. So, yeah.
Awesome. So that's like kind of the, like when I think like for a lot of artists, it is very common at a certain point in their life to kind of go back to their roots or like to their home places. I know, I think it was Samuel D. Hunter. He wrote like Pocatello, Boise, the Case of Existence for God, I think. And I remember watching like one of his interviews because he grew up in Idaho. Oddly enough, I went to grad school in Pocatello too. So I'm like kind of curious about like all these Idaho plays. And he always mentions going back to like kind of childhood nostalgia and like kind of coming from that earnest place as a writer. And I always think, yeah, this is like kind of like looking at parallels between your playwriting, your plays, and then kind of his as well. It's like there's like that unique parallel.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I admire Sam's work immensely. Like that's it. Yeah. I've had the chance to meet him once over Zoom.
Oh my God.
Yeah, he's just a really generous person, just a really, really cool. And he's also I think running a new residency out of Idaho, trying to get more playwrights to make work, you know, in and about the West is my understanding, which is really cool.
That's really, really cool. I'm really glad to hear that. Shelby, can you explain how you ended up with this project?
Totally, yeah. Well, Paul saw a piece I directed called Rich Dogs, which was at the Jungle in the fall of 2023 that I did with my former company, We Are Married. And that was my first main stage directing piece that I had been a part of the devising process. So the creators and I devised that show together and put it up in the Jungle lobby in 2023, and Paul happened to see it, and then we
it was amazing.
Oh, that's so sweet. And then I was surprised to be asked to direct Hot Dish when it was we were working on it at the Playwright Center, because you were a fellow there, Paul, until recently. So the last couple of years you were in fellowship there, and I really was excited that you had that insight, Paul, of me directing your work, because there's a lot of sympathy between what I think you and I are both interested in. So that it worked out really well and has felt really kind of swimming. You know, sometimes people approach you and it's flattering always. It's always nice to be asked. And it's sometimes not always exactly the right fit. And then it was so exciting to know that, wow, this is, I think, really enhancing my work. And I'm really flattered and grateful to have, it's always nice to have someone take a chance on you, no matter what stage you are in your career. It's always a chance. So yeah, that was, that's how I got involved in it. And then the Jungle was generous to let us have a reading there in their Greenhouse series. So that's been thrilling. Yeah.
Yeah. I just kind of want to ask about the Greenhouse series, which I know is like kind of the Jungle's newer, I think it started last year. Somebody can kind of correct me on that. Yeah. I think it started last year. Can you explain what a greenhouse, like a reading series is, to maybe some of our listeners who aren't familiar with what that means in like theater language?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Like, so to do an entire production of a play is so involved and such a huge investment. So a lot of people, a lot of companies want to kind of hear it aloud, almost like a literary, they want to hear the play as a literary object to understand what is this about? Is our audience going to have sympathy with this? They want to invest a little bit before they invest a huge amount of money to produce a show. So maybe that's the sort of, banal way of explaining it. But I do think that is part of the impetus for having these readings is let's see, let's do a little bit and then let's see what people think. I think the other impetus is creative, is like, let's cast a wide net and let's like experiment with some stuff. I think when you're investing in a reading, you can swing for the fences and play with something that is perhaps more out there, a little more surreal, a little more unexpected than you can when you're trying to build a season. So that I think is part of what The Jungle is trying to do. What do you think, Paul? I mean, this kind of gets into like, what are play readings? Like, which I think are, yeah, I think people in theater know what they are. And then I found that people in not in theater don't necessarily know what they are. Yeah, it can be kind of odd.
I think in addition to all those everything you said about the reasons for the Jungle hosting this event live alongside what a gift it is. It's a huge gift that the Jungle is offering to me as a writer, and I think to us as a collaborative team, because it's so funny. Like, plays are such weird creatures in that you write them, but no one no one rarely do people encounter the text. Like, rarely does the thing I write get experienced. What gets experienced are like a production, actors, design. People experience how that text inspires another group of artists. And so what a reading does is it allows me to have, without the big investment of a production, as Shelby said, it allows me to experience what the play might sound like, literally sound like, and then also what those sounds do to a room full of people. I like to say that my job as a playwright is to get a small group of artists excited about a story. Like, my audience are the artists I work with. So like directors, actors, designers. And if I'm lucky enough to work with people who find my writing interesting, or who want to engage with things that I write down, I think the magic actually happens when those things come alive in a room, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I believe that does. I was only introduced to like a group reading. I think it was The Jungle last year, and it was for their Tulipa reading, which I thought was very, very magical and very engaging. And just like somebody like me to kind of have access, easy access to a theater space as well.
Well, and I also want to just really express gratitude to Christina Baldwin and Allison Ruth and Issa Tejeda and all the folks who we've been lucky enough to work with at the Jungle. They've really been wonderful advocates for this work too. And they continue to make, incredible work. I just really love this theater a lot.
It's such a beautiful theater too inside.
It's gorgeous in
Yeah.
there. It really gives you this feeling of like prestige to be in there, which feels really good. And they also are a house in town that is so committed to new local work and excellence in new playmaking, which is not common because it's expensive and risky. So they're consistently advocates for that type of work that is a little bit boundary pushing, that is going to be a little bit unfamiliar for the audience. And they do a wonderful job at kind of synthesizing what feels good for people and what is new and kind of pushes them. So they're very great advocates for all the people Paul just named. Yeah, you're exactly.
Awesome. One of the questions I had about Hot Dish is that it is a all women play, like it's all women casted. And you mentioned earlier that this is basically about the woman in your life. Was there any thought of like having a priest or a father within the play itself? Because it does take like have like a big Catholic heavy influence in there.
Well, and I should say, this is maybe a spoiler, there is one man who is in our
Ooh.
cast.
Okay.
What's so interesting, I think my experience of the church is so embedded and mediated through women, which feels like such a contradiction, because I think of it as a profoundly misogynistic kind of institution. But through my mother's faith, through the faith of the sisters and nuns who taught us, it very much also became my foundational understanding of feminism in a lot of ways. And I think what this play is grappling with for me, and of course I am grappling with this as a cisgender man, and so there are things that I've been really grateful to the collaborators I've been working with to help me understand more deeply an experience that I haven't had, which is that, you know, of being a woman in the church. But it's grappling with that contradiction of this big institution of, and not just the institution of the church, but the institution of gender, and, you know, the institution of being, you know, being gendered and in the Midwest, which is, I think, a really specific thing. Yeah. And Shelby, I'm kind of curious for you. I think I'm in the weeds a little bit in this play too. And so I'm curious, Shelby, like what experiences you've had about, yeah, about gender and this play in the Midwest.
Yeah. Like, so I'm not a woman, I'm trans non-binary. So I often, you know, find myself checking myself, I guess, and going, oh, okay, well, that's not exactly me. But I you know, I feel affiliation with women and was raised around them and was sort of raised to be one. So sort of transgressive in that regard. But I think too, less than gender, I'm thinking a lot about like care with the play, because that's been part of your framing, Paul. So it's like it's a privilege to care for people. It's also a privilege to receive care. So it's just like, who is receiving and giving at that level of care? And yeah, Paul, it's fascinating. It's like, on the one hand, Catholicism is this incredibly patriarchal and misogynistic institution. Then on the other hand, same. Like, I was raised Catholic, and it was like, who was I interacting with? I was interacting with like the CDC teacher, you know, like the catechism teacher, who were all women. I was interacting with like the people that were organizing the, you know, like the evening activities, which were like my only experience of community in a rural town where I was going to the like Polish Catholic church with my babshi, who was insistent that we went twice a week. Like, you know, so all of this was mediated through women, even though it was this incredibly patriarchal institution. So, and that was my entire contact with community care, with kind of learning new things through the church, and with understanding how to function in like a faith-based community. That was entirely women. That there was almost no contact with men. So it was this bizarre gendered thing, but what men were like, irrelevant and excluded. Like, there was no, yeah, I don't know. So that was kind of my experience. So it doesn't strike me as like peculiar at all, or it doesn't stick out to me. It seems almost like high realism, like extremely exact realism. I think that, and then I guess I've had the privilege of being involved in a lot of productions that are huge casts of women or gender non-conforming people. So like, I've been involved in a lot of casts that are, that do like heavily skew towards women. So yeah, that.
Yeah, I guess I was going to use this as a follow-up question for like the large cast. Like, how was it casting this play? Because there is just a lot of women. I know for like one of my plays that I worked on, it was like a light board operator, but it was called Men on Boats. And that's a gender swath one where it's a large cast of women or non-binary folks. So can you explain how you got to that for this production?
How we cast it? Yeah.
Yeah, Shelby, I would love for Shelby to answer this. They have just been working so hard to cast with the, you know, the help of the folks at the Jungle. So.
Well, okay. Something that is interesting about casting is it seems as though, you know, and I'm young in my career, but it seems very much as though no one individual is casting everything. Without fail, I'm having to go to Issa and say, yo, Issa, I need someone who looks this, looks like this, who can do this. And they're going, oh, I know five people. The amazing thing about the Twin Cities is we are stacked with women who are very, very good. Like phenomenally good actors. We are absolutely stacked with that. I think when you first showed me the play, Paul, I was like, well, we could cast this four different ways here. Like, we could have, there are 40 people that could fill each of these roles. So that, in one sense, was easy. And then in another sense, it's also challenging because your voice, I think, is so specific, Paul. So it's, not every single actor can do every single thing. You want to find people who are going to thrive in the role that they've been given. And that's like a delicate art form that I'm just very starting to learn. So that's, I think, fascinating. It was very fun to go through the casting process and think of everyone and go, oh, would they be great at this? Would they, you know, would they thrive with this person? Like, is the chemistry there? It's a wonderful and kind of interestingly artistic part of the process. But everyone gets help with casting. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. That's my thing. Yeah.
Paul, do you have any other thoughts or extra comments on that, or?
God, no, I just have gratitude. I mean, both for Shelby's work and then also what actors do is pretty magical. I have tried, and it is not something that I am skilled at. I just admire the, it is just really courageous to put your body and your voice in front of people. Like, that is a really courageous act that I often cannot do. which is why I love to have the control of writing something down and then having other people be looked at. So, yeah, no, I think it's just gratitude is what I want to say.
Awesome. I want to add to that, which is just to say that your plays demand vulnerability of people first, and then they also demand that they show that they're experts. Something. So it's cool, Paul, because you get to see people really broken down in your plays, and then you get to see them like excel and be heroes and excellent. So that's also a fun challenge. I'm an actor myself, and it's that's thrilling. Those are the kinds of roles you want. So Paul's definitely writing those, the kind of parts that you want, I think, as an actor or as an actress. Yeah.
I had a question for Paul about just kind of like writing comedy or like surrealistic kind of comedy. Yeah. I've heard, I'm not a writer. I did a lot more technical writing, but I've always heard in the creative process, like writing's like, comedy's like the hardest thing to write. The hardest thing to write, the first to age the worst, just due to like kind of the context sometimes it's created in. Have you done a lot of comedies in your past work? Do you plan to do more comedies, surrealistic kind of type of work like this? And how does Hot Dish kind of fit into your creative process?
Yeah, I think I love to experience comedy. I also love funny people, and I love being around people who are funny. And I feel like kind of really since... maybe even a little bit before the pandemic, I've been using pleasure as a guide in my own work and what is pleasurable to bring people together. And I think comedy fits that. I've heard that also, that comedy is hard to write. I think that's true. I think the thing you need to be writing is always the easiest and hardest thing to write, which is why you need to be writing it.
Yeah.
I think that is, I think sometimes maybe what people are talking about too is that in writing comedy, often there's an attention to craft. And by craft, I mean writing in a way where that you're conscious of how something sounds, of literally how like a sentence will land. I've been, you know, really, really lucky to have a couple of opportunities recently to learn more about that. I taught a class, and I was a fellow at the Playwright Center called Jokes for Plays, where we got an amazing group of folks together. And over the course of 6 weeks, we just looked at different joke structures, literally starting with knock-knock jokes. And finally, I mean, the result was like, we destroyed comedy because, you know, we like are pulling things apart. And why does that make you laugh? And so often what makes people laugh is surprise, social connection, discomfort, the release of tension often is what makes folks laugh. I feel like a novice in the world of comedy. I only recently, kind of in the last maybe 5 to 6 years, went from someone who kind of wrote plays that made people chuckle to like, saying out loud, I am writing a play, and the goal of this play is to make people laugh. It's new. And I think to answer your question, yeah, I hope to keep writing comedies.
And kind of another follow up question, especially in the plot of the play, where it's like MLM schemes are extremely common in church groups.
Yeah.
It seems like it's a very universal, like church universal kind of culture. But like, when I went to Idaho, it was like the Mormons had a lot of MLM schemes, evangelical. Was there a reason? Was that just like, oh, you know, if I'm setting a church with women, an MLM scheme is going to have to be involved somehow? Was that just like, I'm assuming like kind of a natural thought process towards that? Or yeah.
Yeah, it just it, I was it's kind of in the vein of like the hot dish in the kitchen and the Virgin Mary of just things that seem like women's property in the middle of the country that just yeah, like th I'm thinking about like Tupperware and Mary
Avon.
Kay,
Yeah.
Avon, and you know, even Primerica. It's just there is a gendered quality to it that I think is scary and interesting and yeah, that's where that came from. And then there also was this way. So I looked at a lot of Marian apparitions in thinking about this. I watched this movie that they showed us. So I went to Catholic school, K through 12, and one of the movies they showed us was The Song of Bernadette, which I think is from the 20s or 30s. I should look. I actually don't know when it was made, but it's about a Marian apparition. And the structure of a lot of these Marian apparitions feel to me like an MLM scheme, where she appears to often the most powerless person in a community and has demands that they go and build a church somewhere. And it does kind of feel like the way that a Mary Kay salesperson might approach a potential sales associate. There's a quality of like, I want something from you, I need you to do something for me. And you are someone with not a lot of power. That is at the, yeah, it seems like it's at the heart of a lot of Marian apparitions that happen. I'm thinking of like the Virgin of Guadalupe and Our Lady of Lourdes, Our Lady of Church. Like it's, yeah, it's really interesting to me.
Huh. I never would have thought of that, but that is actually kind of a really interesting connection. I am going to probably wrap up here pretty soon. I do have one last kind of question here is I'm not from the Midwest. I'm not from the upper Midwest. I did not know what a hot dish was until I moved here, which caused me some Googling. And I have to have like a hot dish recipe, but I did not know this. Is there like there's a cheese on top of the tater tots? And then some people don't put cheese on top of the tater tots. And do you put cheese on top of your tater tots or not cheese on top of the tater tots? On your own personal tater tot dish recipe.
Well, I gotta say, oh, Shelby, you go.
Well, I'm not from here, right? So I'm still learning this hot dish type stuff that there's a starch, there's some kind of vegetable, some kind of meat, and then cheese. So that's like the extent. I don't think I think I made one tater tot hot dish before. It was delicious. I think I did put cheese on top. What do you do, Bob?
You know, I grew up, the word hot dish to me applies to any manner of things that gets baked and eaten. Sometimes involving tater tots, sometimes not. But I will say, if cheese is an option, I'm from Wisconsin, always there's cheese involved. Always. But I do think in other parts of the country, we call this a casserole, which can be a lot of different things. So that's what I grew up understanding was that a hot dish can, you know, I have a memory of someone once making a lasagna and calling it a hot dish.
What?
So ziti, anything else, the culture gets completely erased and subsumed
Yeah, into
into
the
the Midwest.
category of hot dish.
Beautiful.
Lasagna hot dish. Oh my God. I don't know how I feel about that.
Right.
But the tater tot one is that's classic. That's
Yeah,
the
because
yeah.
I always thought hot dish always had to have tater tots. And I
It
guess that
definitely helps.
yeah. Can't
Throw them in, why not?
Oh man. Also a lot of canned soups. You get canned soups and vegetables involved.
There we go.
Canned mushroom is the one that I've always
In the
that was what I
mushrooms.
use. Yeah.
Yeah.
It had to be Campbell's brand for some
Oh
reason.
yeah, no doubt.
Yeah. Loyalty, brand loyalty.
Oh yeah.
And that kind of like the other thing that I think Midwesterners do in cuisine that is just baffling is what we call salads. Like really anything that you can throw in a bowl and eat with a fork could be a salad. It really is broad. Doesn't need to have vegetables involved at all.
Yeah, like a Snicker salad.
Sweet, savory. The thing that boggles me is the sweet savory crossover. It's kind of like the salad can be very sweet. It's fine. Yeah.
That's fine. It's
That's
fine.
confusing.
Salad. Yeah.
It's a lot.
Thank you, Paul and Shelby, for your time with us today. Hot Dish will be performing at the Jungle Theater September 8th. That is a Monday. Tickets and more information can be found at thejungletheater.org. If there is a chance of a sellout risk, you can always hang out near the box office and see if you can snag yourself a last-minute ticket. All right, folks, thank you so much. This was Right on Radio.